The New York Knicks team that featured Walt, Clyde, Frazier, Bill Bradley, Willis Reed, and Dave DeBuscher was no dynasty. The Knicks won championships in 1970, 1973, and that was that. But in his new book, When the Garden Was Eden, Harvey Araton contends that those Knicks, quote, gave fans a symbol of harmony that was especially welcome and necessary at the time. Harvey Araton joins me now from NPR's New York Bureau. Harvey, welcome back to Only a Game.
So great to be here, Bill.
First, in the interests of full disclosure, I grew up in New Jersey. I was a fan of those Knicks teams, particularly Walt Frazier. But tell me why those particular Knicks were any more symbols of harmony than any other successful basketball team.
Well, I think the Knicks were the perfect team for their time and place. And given the fact that they came of age in the late 60s and that their nice little run of 5 or 6 years, 3 finals, 2 titles, lasted into the early 70s, that the team provided something of a soothing element in New York at a time when the city was, and the country, of course, were going through tumult. It was a racially balanced team. It was a team that was considered the ultimate in sort of a democratic style of play. It was an intelligent, committed, and very charismatic team. You know, there was sort of like this sense of a Broadway play that symbolized the best of America at a time when the country was sorely lacking.
Perhaps the most dramatic single moment explored in your book involves a championship series Game 7, no surprise there, and it involves the sudden, somewhat unexpected appearance of Knicks center Willis Reed on the court.
He's 25 feet out left side, and he one-hands, and he hits. Willis Reed is all right. The Lakers have stopped, and they're just watching Willis go through his warm-ups.
Tell us a little bit about that moment, please.
He got hurt in Game 5 in the first quarter, and the Knicks miraculously won that fifth game. He did not play in Game 6 in Los Angeles when Wilt Chamberlain went off for 45 points and 27 rebounds. The team came out to warm up without him. A few minutes after that, an African-American player comes walking down the runway. The crowd rises to start cheering and then suddenly sits back down when they realize it's Cassie Russell. And so, you know, they're sitting there. Fans are literally freaking out. And all of a sudden, after being shot up with, you know, with lots of drugs to numb the pain that was shooting down his leg, Willis makes his appearance. So that was really the first inkling. You know, I mean, today we would have had updates on Twitter 24/7.
He would have been updating us on Twitter.
Absolutely. You know, I'm sitting here getting shot up with the medication as I speak. So it was just an incredible rush for everybody. I mean, players who were on the court said like they felt as if the noise just level lifted everyone off the floor, that it was vibrating. You know, Willis comes out, hits the first 2 shots, really doesn't do very much at all after that. And I got to know Willis as well as, you know, the other principals on those teams. And by the time I was done, there was absolutely no doubt in my mind that Willis was not only the captain of that team, he was the heart and soul and really was pretty much responsible for everything that went on karma-wise with that team.
Lots of Knicks fans knew Walt Frazier as Clyde, the exemplar of ultimate cool, who wore fur coats and wide brim hats and allegedly had a bachelor pad as fine as anything Joe Namath could have imagined. Was Walt Clyde?
Clyde was really kind of an alter ego created by Frazier in terms of the way he dressed and the way he acted and the image that he put forward, to essentially compensate for the fact that he was a very shy man. And he didn't really have to do much. He didn't really have to even say much. He just allowed people. He would let photographers come in and shoot his bedroom with his mink-covered bed and the mirrors on his ceiling. And just the photos and the imagery, you know, created that whole persona for him.
I had known that Jerry Lucas, who was certainly a force on those Knicks teams, had various aptitudes that had nothing to do with basketball. I had not known that he was in the habit of ripping out pages of the New York phone book and memorizing them. Why did he do that?
Well, because, you know, as Dave DeBuscher liked to say, that he was, you know, the provider of endless, useless information. And Jerry's mind works and still works very differently. So he really, you know, saw New York, coming to New York, as an opportunity to kind of market himself, much like Walt Frazier, with his kind of strange abilities to retain information. I mean, he would do stuff like during timeouts, count the number of steps leading up an aisle to, you know, to the mezzanine level, and turn around and say to the busher, hey, you see that aisle over there? There's 300 steps walking up to the top. And he would rip out pages of the Manhattan telephone book, and he would take them on the road. And while Bill Bradley was reading up on politics and Phil Jackson was reading, you know, sophisticated novels, Lucas had, like, hidden in a like in his newspaper, let's say, the pages of the phone book, and he would memorize the entire directory. And then he would go on Johnny Carson and recite entire pages of the telephone directory while Carson would sit there in utter amazement. And he did wind up cashing in big time with that, you know, with this whole persona, because he wound up with a couple of magic shows on TV. He really did wind up making it a sort of an alternative career, which he still is involved in. He still does his sort of Jerry Lucas special learning, you know, processes that he writes books and does a lot of appearances.
Harvey, in researching this book, you spoke with all the available former Knicks. Do you have a sense of what, if anything, being a part of those teams still means to any of those former players today?
I think it's sort of like an old army unit or something that achieved great success in some battle. They really do believe, despite the gnashing of teeth in Boston over the attention the Knicks got, because let's face it, what they did was kind of a drop in the bucket compared to the Celtics. But again, the players, Bradley speaks about this eloquently in the book, the players really believe that they participated in something special and groundbreaking in terms of where professional basketball would go.
I'm speaking with Harvey Ariton, author of When the Garden Was Eden, and you're listening to Only a Game. As you point out in the book, Knicks fans have been enduring all manner of incompetence, buffoonery, and worse for many years now. Is there any reason to think that New Yorkers will see another edition of Eden-like days at their garden anytime soon?
Well, it's a fascinating discussion. That team, in terms of the modern sports era in New York, was probably the most beloved, because in other sports, you know, the city was divided between National League and American League, AFL and NFL. But I do think that today's young people, today's fans, are conditioned in a different way than we were growing up with our sports teams. I mean, free agency was not even on the radar back in 1969-70. I think young fans today, my kids who love basketball, they're used to seeing teams being put together in what I like to call the microwave. So, you know, Carmelo Anthony, let's say Amari Stoudemire is signed as a free agent, and then Carmelo Anthony comes aboard. And there's a possibility, depending on the outcome of the current labor negotiations, that Chris Paul or someone of that nature could be added to the team in the next year and a half or so. But I think young fans are more of accepting of that. And so the way they would become completely immersed in, you know, a team and their pursuit of a championship is different from the way we did. So if you talk to a lot of today's fans who are 35, 30 years old, when you say good old days, they think of John Starks dunking over Michael Jordan. You know, Peter DeBuscher, who I interview in the book, Dave's son, wasn't born for that first championship. So when he talks about, you know, his favorite days as a Knicks fan, it's those days in the 90s when they played against Jordan and Reggie Miller, and he would sit at courtside with his father before his dad died in 2003. That's his good old days. So the perspective of the fan, I think, will shape the kind of love affair that eventually is created if the Knicks continue to grow as a team.
Harvey Ariton is the author of When the Garden Was Eden, Clyde the Captain, Dollar Bill, and the Glory Days of the New York Knicks. The book is published by Harper, and the author joined me from NPR's New York Bureau. Harvey, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Bill, it's always a pleasure. I enjoy it.
Say, go, New York, go, New York, go! Go, New York, go, New York, go! We're back on track on the fourth, scoring more is 94, and the Knicks are hardcore, and I'll tell you like this, we ain't never looked sharper. With Hubert, Bonner, Gray, and Harper, it's the Knicks. And we're back on pace, everyone's gearing up for the championship race, and the fans are going crazy, and they're doing it for a reason, cause 94 is the Knickerbocker season. You better believe the Knicks got all that takes. We're shooting three-pointers, and we're running fast breaks, and if your defense makes a mistake, then bam, you ain't dunks in your face.
This is a team you don't want to miss. We are New York. We are the New York Knicks. Go New York, go New York, go.
It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. Nuance, offering Dragon 11 speech recognition software for creating documents and emails and surfing the web all by speaking at nuance.com. And Oliver Wyman, a global management consulting firm with 3,000 professionals serving global 1,000 companies, oliverwyman.com. This is NPR.
Indonesia and Malaysia have traditionally argued about maritime territories and the origin of various culinary delights. They've also argued about soccer, and they continue to do so. In the first leg of a recent competition between the two nations, the Indonesian players walked off the field, claiming that Malaysian fans were assaulting them with laser beams. They lost the game 3-0. Last weekend, fans of the Indonesian team were frustrated when they found that all 88,000 tickets for the second leg of the competition had been sold, so they set a ticket booth on fire. Hard as it may be to believe, that tactic failed. No additional tickets materialized. Neither could anybody see that the maritime disputes or the food controversies had been much affected by the burning ticket booth.